stunning conclusion.
Yes.
Or a flourish. That flourish, you should have checked the option block on that.
No,
we didn't get the
order. Order that.
Yeah.
We always just order the ordinary one.
So I'm afraid you just set the old name. Thank you everybody for coming. You cheated death. At least we're not doing the snow stuff this time. I like that. Tonight we're going to be doing the last couple of chapters in the book, chapter 8, and then there's an afterword. And it's on conduct. And what it's really on is the precepts. He goes through the precepts quite a bit. And I'll start off by, and again, if you guys have any questions during my talk, feel free to raise your hands. I'm going to be asking you some questions just to make sure you don't fall asleep on me. Okay. The cornerstone of being a mature adult rests on living an ethical life. And I said mature and ethical. And now I'm going to say to have a meaningful life is dependent upon spiritual practices. And the way I kind of look at it in my life is ethics and spiritual kind of meld together in one. And that's why I'm a Buddhist, because we have both of those. The path is comprised of three parts, which are ethical conduct, meditation, and wisdom. The ethical conduct, I think, pertains more to the ethical life. And the meditation and wisdom, of course, are, well, the wisdom's 50-50. But the meditation is more spiritual. And I learned how, when we talk about conduct and precepts and ethics, I realized a bunch of years ago, I was really deficient in those areas. I was in the military, and I had a young lieutenant that had basically done a lot of things he wasn't supposed to do. He acted recklessly, to make a long story short. And he was brought before myself and a couple other gentlemen to decide on what we would do with this guy. Whether we would release him from service or keep him around. And so being the good student I am or was at that time, I went into the library and I started reading anything I could on ethics. And I was absolutely appalled because it just wasn't there. I couldn't find really anything that that I was looking for. So finally it boiled down to I had to rely on a couple of questions. Is this guy, has he learned a lesson? And if we keep him around, is that for the good of the service? And we didn't keep him around. My point being that I was just flailing around blind. Anybody that's been a supervisor in this room knows how devilishly hard it is sometimes to make those personnel decisions. You know, whether you give a guy a raise, or you admonish him, or anything else. So those kind of decisions are really tough. One of my coworkers, after we made the decision, kept revisiting it over and over and over again. Did we make the right decision? You know, just about drove himself crazy. We had no guidance. It's not taught anymore in schools. I think at one time it was. Maybe that went the way of grammar. I'm not too sure. I got a taker there. I knew you would. Everybody makes mistakes. That's a big clue there. But what Norm says, it is essential that we feel remorse. And I think what he was getting to there was that if we don't have a basic understanding of right and wrong, then there's very little that setting ethics is going to do for you, because you can't apply it. You have to have that deep-seated feeling like that was wrong. You know, I'm not too sure what I did, but it just doesn't feel right. And if you have that, then you know, you're in good shape. You know, you're teachable. He says that you should look deeply at your mistakes, and we tend not to do that. You know, we tend to minimize any mistake we make. You know, I wasn't so bad. It was just kind of sort of out of the line a little bit. But he says, don't do that. Feel them deeply. And what we need to do is to correct them as soon as we can. If necessary, sometimes confession is a good thing. If you did something you know, if you bring it up, you might lose your job or something like that. Well, maybe what you need to do is find some wise person that you trust and tell him what you did. And the tough one is forgive yourself. That is hard. Because I think all of us, at least I do, have a sense that maybe I deserve it, maybe I didn't measure up. That feeling of self-worth sometimes will get in the way. You deserved it, you should have studied harder, whatever. But sometimes our biggest critic is ourself. We do it to ourselves. And he says that sometimes it'll take a long time to do this. It may take years, and yeah, I've still got a few things rattling around my caves that have been there for 10 or 20 years that I'm working on. But I don't really agree with that, and here's why. I think the more, we're better off if we can kind of clear the decks as soon as we can, because people tend to hold on to those things that we've done that we haven't quite settled with ourselves. And then we run them through our head again and again and again, you know? And every time we do that, I believe that we entrench that thought a little bit deeper in my brain again and again and again. It's like playing a record over and over again with a bad needle. It just messes up the groove, and it cuts deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's harder to get rid of. If you're going to really try to resolve one of these mistakes, why suffer for that long of a time? Why not, as soon as you can, get rid of the thing? Do what you need to do. Admit a mistake. You know, confess it if you have to, and forgive yourself. Get it done. I've got a question for you. We've been talking about, you know, delaying resolution of a problem. Why would we do that if we know if we know we're probably going to wind up in the same place with the issue resolved? Why do we seem to wallow in all that extra pain? Anybody? No?
I think sometimes it's It's because it's such a huge, horrible thing that I can't come to terms with it. Right? I can't even imagine what it would be or what it would do if I came out with it. And so it's this kind of way of trying to like push it down and cover it up, and you know, it's not conscious that I'm wallowing in it. It's, you know, I just can't deal with it. I'm pushing it down, but of course, you know, it's still there. And it is true that it, you know, most often those things, you know, just build up deeper grooves, and you know, and then years later you see, oh, it's still there. But I think so much of it is this, you know, denial and not being able to really accept that huge mistake or whatever that I made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, and so, you know, trying to kind of escape. You know, I think that's a lot of kind of, at least, you know, in my experience, what things that are, that I've done that were so huge, you know, I didn't want to, you know.
Kind of like pushing a beach ball in a swimming pool down under the water and have it pop.
Yeah.
Keep popping back on you.
Yeah.
Sean, you were going to say something?
Oh, similar. Just the fear of actually going through the experience of maybe apologizing to someone or admitting, you know, you have to feel your own pain about it, and maybe some fear of what can get back.
Mm-hmm.
So just trying to avoid that.
A lot of fear, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just indecision in the sense of not knowing all the perspectives or being unsure that you've covered all the bases and so forth, all the different perspectives there could be. You know, and also probably trying to meet the expectation of peers,
mm-hmm.
different groups of people. You know, you somehow feel accountable to them in some strange way that you do. And you're just trying to balance out those. And really taking your eyes off the ethical decision.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really think it feels to me, at least maybe in my case, but
can you speak up? I'm kind of like
it's like fully admitting to myself that I really did it. if I don't tell the person and apologize, maybe I can kind of pretend that maybe I didn't do that, or maybe they didn't notice enough for me to have to say anything. And yeah, so the behavior doesn't really get transformed much if you don't fully come out of it.
So it's, I had a friend of mine say it's better to die than to look bad.
Yeah.
Kind of like that.
Yeah.
But basically you guys nailed it. It's fear, you know. It's doing something we haven't done before, and the only way you get better at that is to do it. And the second time it's not as bad. Sometimes it helps to cut the big thing up into little chunks, not take the whole thing at once.
Mm.
And a lot of it, like what you're talking about, Bob, is I think centers around the ego, you know. We hate to admit that we've made a mistake. And if we do that, we don't learn anything. So the mistake goes, you know, it's a shame to waste a mistake because you don't learn a lot from them. Well, it's fine. At the end of the day, and it's kind of like what we're just talking about, one of my habits was to look at everything we had done that day. Look at the good stuff and the bad stuff. And also talk to the rest of the crew and say, you know, did something go wrong today or did something go really right? And learn from that. There's a term for it called chair flying. And every day you kind of clean house. And those things you didn't do so well, you try to figure out a way not to do that again. And the things that went extremely well, you try to figure out a way to keep doing the same thing. And it really sounds pretty simplistic, But in practice, it really isn't. Because you're admitting to yourself and a bunch of other people that maybe some of these things didn't quite go the way, you know, they should have gone today, you know. But it was really valid. And in some cases, it was the only way to really learn the ropes, was because there was some of the stuff we did wasn't in the books, so you kind of make up your own books and book, and that was the way you did it. What do you thought, folks? I'm sorry?
Sorry, I just wanted to add something that I've noticed about myself and mistakes is that I feel pretty good when I'm the one admitting my mistake. There's some ego in that, like, professionally. I noticed this, that I did it poorly. Huge difference when someone points it out to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm suddenly defensive. I didn't do that. Like, the immediate reaction is crazy. First, in a, given a few minutes, I will recognize that, yes, I did do that, but I can't. It's very different when someone else points it out to me. I want to beat them to what I did wrong.
Yeah.
There's something safer in that. It's just worth noticing for me the big difference between being pointed out to me and for me to notice it first.
And what suffers?
Very much the ego, because the ego is very much involved in noticing that I made a mistake, and I'm strong enough to admit it. But
in about everything we've talked about in this whole book, the 500 pound gorilla in the room is ego, in most cases. You keep working on that one of these days. He talked about bodhisattvas quite a bit, and I think most of the things, you know, kindness and all the other things that bodhisattvas are concerned with has to do with interconnectedness. And basically, I love what Dogen said at one time. I don't know if you guys have read that or not. He said that and I can't remember where I read it, but he said that if someone's meditating or praying in one area, it sends out ripples and it changes everything it hits throughout the universe. It's like, almost like one of those quantum mechanic things. You know, one little change over here makes a change an infinite number of places across the universe, and I've always liked that. So, if you think about it, if I do a, you've already heard me say that I can only be as happy as the people around me, and I think that's probably where that comes from a little bit. But a kindness done to anybody is a kindness done to all. And it even comes back to me in a lot of different ways. And the same attitude is also true of the precepts. You know, Kent would say, you know, if you do, I need to do what I want everybody else to copy, and vice versa. If I do good, then everybody gains from that, and so do I. So with that in mind, we should always put out the effort to conduct ourselves with kindness, wisdom, and skill. And I love that quote of the Dalai Lama in the book that says, "My religion is kindness." He's a wonderful man. To be truly mature is to always make the effort to conduct yourself and act with kindness, wisdom, and skill. so we can choose helpful action for a given situation. That's a response. You know, that's our response. But the first thing that we really need to do is to look at what's before us before we respond to it. In a lot of cases, when I look at something right in front of me, if it's something that I don't want to do, I try to, you know, do one of those things to do a sidestep. But to truly be a Buddhist, I think that you have to not sidestep anything, you know. I mean, there's some things that I can't do without help, you know, that's okay. But not to sidestep around anything that you come in contact with, and then act with kindness, wisdom, and skill. And that pretty well covers the precepts. They're very practical, and he, Norm talked about comparing them to koans, which just drives me absolutely bonkers because I am no good with koans. I'm working on it, but it's not there yet. And there's not enough time to fully discuss them, so I'm not gonna. And you can't make me. But there is a book that I read that's really good. Maybe some of you have read it. It's called Being Upright by Rev Anderson. Anybody read that? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it really covers precepts well, and it gave me a lot of clear-cut examples of what he was talking about. And I have the kind of brain that needs a lot of examples. So if you really want a good education in the precepts, I highly recommend that book. So I'll just go through the precepts quickly. The precepts are not something, you know, we talked about goals and vows the other night. And the precepts are an absolute vow, because we're probably never going to be able to accomplish that. But the joy and the meaning of life is just in trying to do those things. It gives us direction. And in that respect, it's extremely valuable. The first was a triple treasure: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I don't think I have to, you know, Buddha is our true nature, Dharma, according to him, it's an understanding of life, and Sangha is, again, the interconnectedness of all beings. The next are the three pure precepts, and these are wholesome or unwholesome actions. And they're pretty basic. They basically say, don't do those things that cause suffering. Do those things that create happiness in others and in yourself, and always act with others in mind. You know, the golden rule. Do unto others. And where it kind of gets interesting is the 10 grave precepts of conduct. And this is as close to, I think, the 10 commandments as we get in Buddhism, you know, not to do something. But we never forget the 10 commandments. The 10 commandments are directive, and the precepts are a way of life. And there's a huge difference between the two. But the first one is not to kill, but to nurture life, to respect all beings. And there we get into something that's always interesting when Buddhists talk about it, is food. How do we eat and still carry this precept? There's vegans, vegetarians. I use meat as a flavoring, but that's as far as it goes. I don't think I haven't had a steak in 30 or 35 years. But there's some people that really feel pretty strongly about that. And my feeling is that we honor those people and those living things that give us nourishment. I think the Indians were, the American Indians were right on, where they would celebrate. You know, they're subsistence hunters. I lived in Alaska. I know something about that because that's all they have to eat. But they have really ornate ceremonies honoring the animal that gave them sustenance. Anybody want to jump in here? Because usually that's a... How do you guys look at food? Vegetarian? I imagine there's a lot of vegetarians in here. And vegans. Nobody has a Big Mac on the, Big Mac on their grip.
We raise pigs and we eat them, where I live. And I think, to a certain degree, all eating is killing something. And it's to the degree. I don't think there's any justification, much justification for me to be eating pigs. I did spend about 15 years of my life being vegetarian until I became a farmer and noticed that so much of farming was killing something. And I know there's the wide range of bugs versus a cow. But I just think there's a difficult, tricky territory, and it's worth keeping my eyes wide open to the suffering that I may be causing, and be with the emotions and not try to ignore them or deny them. But what's coming up in me as to how I'm participating in the cycle of life.
Thank you. That's a tough one, Bob.
I did all of that. I think maybe a lot of people have. I was sort of vegetarian at once for a long period of time, but I definitely was never going to give up eating crab for some reason. I was like, nope, not that. Yeah, that was same. I'm not that way anymore that way. Sometimes I think I should be eating less meat. But I have animals on my farm, and I have a really strong policy that I don't kill any animals that I have, care for. So that's just a sort of a thing. It comes from having worked on a little farm, little homestead kind of place, and not enjoying that dynamic that I had to be involved in there, where some animals were treated this way and some were treated that way. So, although just a couple days ago I had to be restrained from killing that possum. I did hit him with a stick a couple times, and it didn't seem to have any effect. So I let it be, and later I had other discussions with him the next day as he kept coming around. Got right down close and personal with him, and later found him rooting through the recycling like some kind of hobo, and I felt pretty sorry for him, and I was glad I didn't kill him. He's probably not doing too well. He was messing with the chickens, but he didn't get any of them, which was good. But it's a tough one, you know? It's a toughie, yeah. So I defend my animals, and I have killed predators that were coming after my animals, but, you know, it's hard.
I had an aunt down in Texas, and she's cooked every wild game under the sun. And her attitude is, if you shoot it, you eat it. Real simple. The second one is stealing, and that comes from a feeling that there's not enough going around, and I want mine. And again, that's fear, that's ego. But the same token, the flip side of that is generosity, being able to accept it graciously. And that's kind of hard for some of us. You know, that's one that I'm learning, you know, all the time. Because, you know, more and more I ask for help, and people are really gracious about giving it out. And it wasn't easy to start with, but like what we're talking about, the 27th or 500th time you do it, it does get a little bit easier. So I think it's something that we need to practice, graciously receiving things. The third one is not to misuse sexuality. I thought about that a little bit. And the only thing I can think of is what might help is sit down with a trusted friend, someone you really trust, and have a conversation on that. Because a lot of time people, you know, when it comes to sex, we get so balled up in our head, it's tough to see where we're going or see the truth. And usually a second set of eyeballs will really, really help out. Of course, there's always professional help too, if you can afford that. The fourth one is not to lie, but to be truthful. And the thing about being lying is you have to keep covering it up. We got to remember what the lie was, who we told it to, under what circumstances. And have you ever noticed somebody that's telling a lie, the lie keeps getting longer and longer and longer? Mm-hmm. The excuse gets a little bit longer each time. Well, I would love to come fishing with you, Bob, but I told my wife that we'd go to the antique store, and she really wants to do that. Oh, she's looking at a certain kind of pot, and on and on and on. You know, and the truth is, I don't want to go. If we do that, there's really no way to have a relationship with another person if you lie. You can't do it. Because you're always going to be caught in that web. You can't, you'll never be relaxed enough, really, to tell the truth because you're worried about what you said. And I did like that. It affects our relationships. And a new word for 2019 is truthiness. Have you guys heard that word, truthiness? It's one of those Trumpian things. So I'm sure they'll be adding that to the dictionary soon. The fifth one's not to become intoxicated with substances, and this is the interesting part, are doctrines. I've never heard that before. And I thought about that a little bit, and it certainly is true now, isn't it? You know, we rant and we rave and go absolutely nuts, and it is a form of intoxication. You know, if you look at the folks at Charlotte last year, you know, the skinhead Nazi folks. That was a form of intoxication, pure and simple, you know. Guy rang a car into some pedestrians. You know, that's something you would expect and, you know, expect a drunk to do, but not someone sober. So it can be just as dangerous, a doctrine can be just as dangerous as an intoxicating substance, depending on how we react to it. So if you spend any time yelling at your TV set during the nightly news, you might want to watch that one. Not to speak of others' faults, but to speak of loving kindness. And I really like that one. I had a little story to go with it, but I'm not going to do that now. And one that's real close to it is praise self, not to praise self at the expense of others, which is the same kind of in reverse, but it's more direct. We're puffing up ourselves directly, instead of making the other person look bad to make us look good, we're making ourselves look good directly. But the rationale is the same. It's just, again, ego. Not to be possessive of anything, but to be generous. And then we get into the grasping and clinging, don't we? Everything that we have, we will lose. We had a really great exercise in here where we kept checking off things that were important to us in life. And every time you lose something, it's suffering. And the more stuff you have, the more stuff you're going to lose, and the more you're going to suffer. And that just doesn't sound right. Because a lot of people think that the more stuff you have, the better off you are. But that's not necessarily true. And there's a personal corollary to that coming from me, having a lot of stuff in my life. That anything I buy, I have to find a place for it, someplace in my garage. I have to take care of it, and eventually I'm going to have to sell it. There's a lot of stuff. It's almost like a relationship with stuff. It's a lot of work. I can't even remember how to put gas in half that stuff. And there's a corollary to that. That stuff will expand to fill up the available space. Have you ever noticed that? When I was a contractor, I built a 1,500 square foot addition onto a guy's garage so he could put his canoes in and, you know, up in Anchorage. And I came back a year and a half later, and it not only had the canoes in there, it was full of stuff. It was like CO2 cartridges that had gone off in his canoes. This is a tough one. Not to harbor anger, but to forgive. Anger is a talk in and of itself. It's corrosive. Some of us like it. It gives us a little bit more energy sometimes, and there's that wonderful righteous indignation where you can sit and say, I'm right and you're wrong. And we get a little jolt, a temporary high. The problem with it is that it cuts off any communication you're having with the other person. It's over. You might as well turn around and walk off. And I do enjoy. I've got a wonderful wife, very well educated, And it's amazing to me how intoxicating anger is. Because she turns on the news, and she'll sit there and she'll start watching it. And then she'll start discussing it with the TV. And then her voice gets elevated a little bit. And once her, and sometimes she even starts yelling at the TV set. How ignorant they are, and this and that and the other thing. And being the good Buddhist that I am, I would really like to turn around and tell her that that's probably not a constructive reaction to the TV set. But I really haven't found a way to do that yet. So if anybody has any thoughts along those lines, get with me after the talk. And especially when certain people name whose initials are DT come on, and she goes nuts. Number 10, not to do anything to diminish the triple treasure. And this is basically a continuation step, I think, just to keep in mind that we're never done with the precepts. We have to do it every day for the rest of our life. At the end of this chapter, there's really a beautiful section that requires, and this is chapter 8, that requires reading a few times and a little meditation. It's beautiful. It's only about maybe 2 or 3 pages long, and it's right at the end of chapter 8, but it takes an awful lot of thought. So I would go back and take a look at those pages. If you don't have a book, send me an email, and I'll copy those pages and send them to you. But it's really neat, and but it does require a lot of thought. And this is a Buddha smile, and we'll cap it here. Coming into maturity in this complicated world is a matter of meeting each thing, like we talked about, inside and out, with sensitivity, awareness, and persistence, trust, love, and wisdom. Those are all the things we're talking about. We need these qualities in order to fully meet what's in front of us. When we can do that naturally, we can find our place in the world. When we are willing to stop trying to control what happens and just do what's in front of us, this is where we can find our mature self. The mature self that we're creating is different from that we created in an earlier life. And this is me talking now. As we meet more of life's meetings, we've had a chance to think about and evaluate the lessons we've learned and accumulated. At this point, I find it very enjoyable to pass these lessons on to others. I think that one of the reasons that older people in this culture don't enjoy the veneration of other cultures is they haven't been passing the lessons to the younger people. This, I can't, if you, any teachers in here? You know, I can see why teachers do what they do, because one of the real joys of my life is when, unsolicited, I can explain how I solved a problem to somebody else. You know, sometimes the light bulb goes on, sometimes it doesn't. But that is, I think, the greatest joy that I can get in this stage of my life. I've already done the easy stuff, maturity-wise, got a job, well, I got married, you know, house, cars, all that stuff, paid the insurance bills, done all the things you're supposed to do, you know, got there, found my place there. But once you get there and you learn a whole bunch of other stuff, well, you have to kind of get to some other place to be considered taking my place And that other place for me is to help other people out, to pass on what I've learned, if requested. Some people won't listen to it. Why? And treat the people around me as though they were me, because, like I said, I can only be as happy as everybody in this room. So it's taking my place, but it's a little bit different place than it was 4 years ago. And even though there are some physical problems that go along with being old, her, thank you. It's not so bad, because I've got all these other things that I get enjoyment out of that doesn't dissipate away in 15 minutes. They give me a feeling of real meaning in my life. And that's, I think, what we all look for. I'm sorry, kind of had to squeeze in the last part of it. There'll be I'm going to give another talk on Saturday, I think it is, and I'll fill in the gaps. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you.